But I'm back, and I'm kicking butt and taking names. No, I'm only joking. By the way, my name is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here, so I want to be give you a much more respectful welcome than that. Thank you for coming. We're starting today a series on the book of Revelation. It's called This Is Not the End, and you know, which is, I suppose, a little bit of an oxymoron because Revelation is the end of the Bible. You know, it's the last book. It's also one of the more controversial books of the Bible. Has anybody read it by any chance at all? I mean, if you're honest about it. Read the whole thing? Oh, that's quite a few people. I better be careful what I say then. So, it's one of those books that gets in the news a lot, or a lot of it's publicized a lot. It's one of the more publicized books of the Bible, I would say, because it seems to talk about the end of all things, the end of the world, and that's been popularized in certain quarters, certain parts of our culture, certain parts of the church. We have, I think a lot of writing about, predictions about the future and predictions about the end of the world and that kind of thing. A lot of those do seem to come from interpretations of Revelation. So, it's kind of a tricky book. But we're gonna do a 5-week series. We're gonna take a good, long, hard look at it, and we're gonna look in particularly about how we can apply it to our lives. Now, it's also known as the apocalypse. Even in some Bibles, it gets called that. It'll be called the apocalypse. I'll explain why that is a little bit later. And when we think of apocalypse, for most of us, it doesn't conjure up positive images, right? I mean, it tends to conjure up negative images. Maybe some, this is a photo of some people gathering for the Mayan apocalypse, from 2012. It kind of has a sort of a sinister feel about it. Apocalypse usually sort of seems associated with the end of the world. We also have other sort of graphic images of, perhaps the end of the cosmos, end of the planet even, some kind of Armageddon kind of situation. There's a good old zombie apocalypse, obviously, there's a lot of great movies about that. And we have a lot of movies about post-apocalyptic things and pre-apocalyptic things, but they all tend to be a little sinister, all a little bit scary, all a little bit weird and wonderful. Now, we also have, I don't know, has anybody read any of these books at all? Okay, so very popular books. I was reading the other day, look at the guys, Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. They've sold 65 million copies. I think they've 16 books, I think several movies, and they've, I think 7 of those 16 made the top, the number one on the New York Times bestselling list. A lot of their writing comes from the book of Revelation. I mean, they're kind of authors, you either love them or you hate them. I know some people who, I've never read any of their stuff actually, but so I'm not even going to comment on it because I've never read it, but I know people who love it. I know people who think it's just crazy and it's not, it has nothing really to do with an accurate interpretation of Revelation. But, we have, it's there, it's out there in the culture. We also have, I don't know, have anybody heard of this guy, Hal Lindsey? I remember this book when I was a kid called, I think it's called The Late Great Planet Earth or something like that, which scared the living daylights out of me. It was all about, basically Jesus is coming back soon and you better be careful that you're on the right side. Again, I think this is a photo of him. He has a show. I've not seen the show, but he's somebody who has become famous for using Revelation to make interpretations about the future or to at least to read into current events predictions about those events from Revelation, and then further ahead predictions about possibly the end of the world and that kind of thing. We also, do anybody recognize this guy? Harold Camping. So he predicted that the world was going to end 2011, and I think he was wrong, unless something's happened and I didn't notice about it. He's one of many people who have actually predicted the end of the world using Revelation and using a lot of the numerology that's in Revelation. He's had a few stabs at it, so I'm not sure whether he's gonna have many more. Now, here's the deal. I think it's interesting. It's very easy. I find it, here's a confession, very easy to have a little chuckle about people like that, and even at some of the other writings and things that we've put up there on the screen. But at least you could say these people are wrestling with a book in the Bible. They're wrestling with Revelation. I think my hunch is, even though we did have a lot of hands that went up just now, which I believe to be true and honest, my hunch is that most followers of Jesus don't read Revelation. because it seems weird, because it seems wacky, because it seems awkward and difficult, we avoid it. It's also, when you read it, it can be very harsh and sound judgmental and very difficult. Basically, you know, Revelation is a vision that was sent, somebody called John had. He was on an island in Patmos. We're going to read about this in a second. He had this vision in the first century BCE. He sent this, first century AD, let's say the first century, okay, after, you know, in Jesus' era, just after Jesus. He sent this vision that he had, wrote it down, sent it out to seven churches in Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. And in that vision, he explains to them what's going on in the spiritual realm, in the spiritual dimension, while they're experiencing things in the physical dimension. And what they're experiencing in the physical dimension is really difficult. They're suffering a lot. They're being persecuted. We'll get into that in a little bit, some of the historical context. They're really struggling. And he sends this graphic vision of what's really going on, and it has these two main themes, these themes of the nature of evil and what you do about evil that surrounds us, and is it possible to have hope? Is there hope in the future? And he describes this, what's going on in the current situation, but he also projects into the future, and he says that, you know, one day evil is going to be defeated. You may be suffering and subject to evil right now and struggling with it and having to put up with it right now in all kinds of horrible ways, but, you know, evil is going to be defeated. God's going to defeat evil eventually. And he describes in very graphic images this kind of war that goes on. On the one hand, you have God and all the forces of evil, all the forces of good. You have angels, and you have these creatures around the throne of God, and you have the Lamb, and you have the Son of Man, and you have all these wonderful images. And then on the other side, you have the dragon with the red dragon, the beast with seven heads and ten horns, and another beast. You have the whore of Babylon. You have the Antichrist thrown in for good measure, possibly, although the Antichrist isn't actually referenced in Revelation. You have, you know, all these incredible images that describe this great battle between good and evil, and ultimately good wins. And John has this vision, and he sends it out to these churches as a means to encourage them and challenge them in very difficult circumstances. Now, our challenge, I think, is to work out what did it mean to the people in their situation, and then how can we apply that meaning to ourselves? I mean, some people have applied it, I think, in inappropriate ways. Let's look at a couple more slides here. Some people, okay, again, we're chuckling, we laugh, you know. But I mean, there's people who kind of look at Revelation, which was written 2,000 years ago, and think they were talking about people from in the present day. Now, that may be true. I mean, we may have a view of Scripture that there's these hidden meanings in there and hidden predictions. But people in the first century didn't know who Barack Obama was. They didn't know who Al-Qaeda was. They didn't know what an airplane was. They didn't know what a bomb was. They didn't know, you know. So it would be very unfair of us to try and interpret this in a way that assumes that the original readers would have known everything that we know. Now, I mean, it's not his other thoughts about who the Antichrist might be, for instance. You know, some people were saying that, you know, Saddam Hussein was the Antichrist. Other people, can you believe this? Let's look at the next one. The Pope, I mean, come on, for Pete's sake. But there are some theories out there that the Pope was the Antichrist. You know, so people are applying these things in all kinds of different ways. Again, we, I think, can be, we can laugh. I mean, I've got to confess, there's a chap on the TV, I don't know if you've seen Pat Robertson. Okay, it's very easy for me to laugh at Pat Robertson. Although I think he might be the Antichrist. Do you see he's making the devil sign there with his fingers? Nobody noticed that. I don't know, it's very... But again, what if we were to take this seriously? Okay, so at least he's having a stab at some of these interpretations. Now, I think sometimes he's made some very unkind interpretations. But you know, how are we going to deal with this? We're going to look at this book in its own context. We're going to try and work out, okay, what did it mean when those first readers read it? What would it have meant to them? We're going to take it seriously. We're going to look at it holistically. We're going to look at it as a book itself. So a lot of the theories about the end of the world that have been popularized, and theories about the Antichrist, for instance, don't actually come from Revelation. The Antichrist is not actually mentioned in Revelation. There's a figure in Revelation who might be equated with the Antichrist, but the Antichrist is mentioned elsewhere in the New Testament. So you know, we're gonna just look at Revelation, as a book, and what would it have meant as a book, as a letter sent to those early churches. Now we will see it and look at it in its context in other, you know, in the New Testament, in the Christian scriptures, and also especially, we'll get into that a little bit today, its context in Hebrew writing, and particularly the prophetic tradition within Hebrew writing and Hebrew scriptures, and also the apocalyptic tradition, because there's a tradition of apocalyptic writing. Revelation is not the only piece of apocalyptic literature. We'll look at it in that context. So we'll sort of look around it, but we're going to take it holistically as one book, look at it in its context, and our predominant theme is going to be looking at firstly, the theme of evil and the theme of hope, and then applying that to our own lives. Because if we come out of this without having something that can challenge us and encourage us, it will probably have only just been an intellectual exercise, interesting, stimulating maybe, and I think it will be an interesting series, but we really want to come out of this growing as people. And so perhaps one of the things we need to do right at the beginning is to just, let's put down our preconceived ideas about its wackiness or about its inappropriateness or maybe some of the previous interpretations that we've heard, and just be open to fresh thoughts. I don't mean my thoughts. I'm not here to be the ultimate final word on Revelation. I certainly am not going to be delivering that, so I don't want to disappoint you. But what we will do, I think, is get into the book in some of the broader brushstrokes, so we can kind of get our head around it and see where it fits, see what it looks like, what is its context, and then how can we apply it? Okay, and I think with most books of the Bible, it's kind of a struggle to do that. We can dive in, look at a few verses, and think we know what they mean, but then they can either confuse us or we can misapply them perhaps. We're going to back off from it and kind of look at it in the larger brushstrokes. That's what we'll have time for in these services. Okay, let's just look at, let's break the book down a little. If we could look at the outline of Revelation. And this is my outline. I'm sort of breaking it down a little bit to manage it. This isn't a very sophisticated breakdown. You can read commentaries that have all kinds of literary structure. They see all sorts of literary structure within Revelation, and it's certainly there. But this is, I think, a helpful way for us to look at it. There's a beginning, right? The prologue, chapter 1. We'll look at a couple of excerpts from that in a second, where John basically explains who he is and how he had this vision. And there's a sort of an introduction to these churches he's writing to. Then in the second section, which is chapters 2 and 3, he has seven messages for seven churches. And the churches, as I mentioned, which are all situated on the western side of present-day Turkey in what was known then as Asia Minor. He then goes in, the bulk of the book is this prophetic, apocalyptic vision that he has. It's this drama that's played out in front of him. And he articulates that to the listeners or to the readers. And then right at the end, he closes off, and it's a kind of a blurred ending. There's an epilogue where he sort of comes out of this vision and says some words directly back to the readers again and says, don't change any of this. This was all true. He also inserts some more words from Jesus in there, though, so it's kind of mixed up with almost like a bit of visionary talk as well, but it's kind of an end to the book. He sort of closes it off. Now, let's look at how we're going to handle this series, all right, because we've got 5 weeks, as I mentioned. What we're going to do today, and what we're in the middle of, a little bit of introduction and background, okay, so give us a little bit of context so that as we get into the book, we'll have we'll have our bearings. Next week, we're going to go into chapters 2 and 3. We'll look at the challenges to the churches. What were those challenges? What was the context that the churches were living in at the time? And how can we apply that to our own lives? Then in the third week, we'll get into this apocalyptic vision. And we'll kind of look at some of the imagery. We'll try and work out what certain things mean. What would they have meant to the people at that time? And again, how can we apply that to our lives? And we'll get into all kinds of great stuff like the beast, the red dragon, the son of man, the lamb. We'll get into my personal favorite, the whore of Babylon. I mean, I can't tell you how good it feels to be able to say a term like that in a church, to talk about the great whore of Babylon. It's there in the scriptures. I'm just repeating the scriptures. And number four, week four, we'll look back a bit. Now, because what's going to happen in this series. It's going to bring up issues that are all hot potatoes. And things like, is there a life after death? What happens when you die? What happens if you've been bad? What happens if you've been good? You know, questions that I think are all pretty important to us. Questions like, you know, how is the world going to end? Is it going to end? Is it worth having hope? What do we do with evil in this present age? What do we do about the fact that we are evil? Right? Is anybody here not evil? Have any evil? Okay, so we all have a little bit of evil. I think we'd all admit to that. So, you know, we'll look at some of these issues that are kind of, I think, challenging issues for us, and often controversial issues. And when I want to say up front now, I'm not sure that we're going to come to any definitive answers on those questions, because I think we've all got to, what I want to encourage you to do is all engage with this in such a way that you can wrestle with, well, what do you think? Right? And that, I know that for some people that frustrates them to death, because they just want the pastor to say, here's the truth, here's what's real, here's what's correct. But I think following Jesus means working things out for ourselves, and you know, I want to do whatever I can to help us along that pathway. But you know, we may come to different conclusions, and that's okay. What we don't want to do is just ignore it or just take the lazy option of necessarily just believing somebody else's or settling on somebody else's opinion, because it kind of seems to make sense. We get this opportunity in this next 5 weeks to wrestle with it. And then in week five, we'll celebrate together. We're going to have actually all the kids in here, believe it or not, and we'll just celebrate hope, because the message, the overarching predominant theme of Revelation is we have every reason to have great hope in the future. Things are difficult. Things are difficult now. We all experience suffering in all kinds of different ways. We all experience evil happening to us. We all experiencing evil happening through us. But we can have great hope in the here and now that God is present, and a great hope in the future. So it's a really great message. It's a really wonderful thing for us to celebrate at the end there. Okay, let's just jump in a little bit to Revelation. Okay, so let's look at the very beginning. The revelation of Jesus Christ. So this is chapter 1, verse 1. So this is definitely not the end. It's the beginning of Revelation. But as we'll see, by the way, you know, we're calling the series This Is Not the End because we see, I think we'll see as we go through, that Revelation is the beginning of something. Really, Revelation describes the beginning of something wonderful, rather than it being this cataclysmic end. So chapter 1, verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw. That is, the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. Okay, so John's creating this sense of urgency, and he then goes on to say a few words to the churches that he's writing to. There's a kind of a formal greeting he gives to the seven churches, and we'll talk about those in more detail next week, okay, so we won't get into the specifics of that. But then he goes on later on in the chapter to say this: I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that are ours in Jesus. That's a predominant theme again. He's talking about enduring through suffering. So a lot of what he's writing here is to help people get through some really hard times. We'll talk about those hard times in a minute. So I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that are ours in Jesus, was on the island of Patmos, that's where we're situated, because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. On the Lord's day, I was in the Spirit, and I heard behind me a voice like a trumpet. Okay, now, what he's going to do now, he's not getting into the vision. Going to describe this apocalyptic vision right now. He's telling them how he had it. Okay, but how he had the vision so leads us into this imagery and drama that he uses when he describes the vision. Okay, so here's what happened. The voice, like a trumpet, said, write on a scroll what you see and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me, and when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe, reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest. His head and hair were white wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze, glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. Okay, so there we have, you know, that pretty much ends up chapter 1. So what can we sort of draw from that beginning? Okay, so this is just introductory, looking for some context. Well, firstly, John, and we'll talk about who John is in a second, but John describes his message as a prophecy. And that roots what he says right at the beginning. He says that in verse 3. It roots what he's about to say, or what the readers are about to read, in a very rich tradition of Hebrew prophecy. You know, we've talked many times here about the Hebrew prophets, people like Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Hosea, Amos. You know, we have these writings in the Hebrew scriptures, what we call the Old Testament, from about the 8th century on, 8th century before Christ, on, where the prophets wrote down what they heard and what they saw, the words they got from God. I mean, prophecy was happening before that, but this was kind of the era where it was written down. And we have those records now. And those people in John's day would have had those records. They'd have read those scriptures, and they'd be very familiar with the prophetic tradition. And so when John describes what he's doing and what he's saying as a prophecy, it kind of puts him in that context. It conjures up all kinds of thoughts and feelings for the people reading it. The first word of this book is apocalypsis. That's what the Greek word that we translate revelation. That's why the book's called Revelation, and sometimes why it's called the apocalypse. Apocalypsis, the revelation, means revealing. That's why, you know, that's the interpretation. It means revealing. It means unveiling. All right, so that's another thing we can get from this, that this is apocalyptic literature. Okay, we'll talk about in a second the fact that prophetic literature in the Hebrew times evolved into apocalyptic literature. It changed a little bit in the times at the, you know, around the first few centuries before Jesus came on the scene. There's writings that we have that we can read today. Some of them appear in the Bible, many of them don't. But there was a genre of literature called apocalyptic writing that differed a little. It was kind of an evolution of the prophetic writing. We'll explain more about that in a second. But it's important to note that John kind of conjures up those images. So this is a prophetic vision he's having, but it's an apocalyptic message. And so this is apocalyptic literature. And people would have recognized that when they're reading it. As I said, we'll talk about that more in a little bit, and actually throughout the series, but I think it's important to bear that in mind right from the beginning, that there was a context for these people as they read it. It's written by John. John declares who he is. He says, "I, John, send you this letter." Okay, so who was John? Well, the tradition is, and you know, most people would say that it's John the Apostle. It was the guy who was the follower of Jesus, the son of Zebedee. John, who was with Jesus when Jesus was walking around Galilee and going down to Jerusalem. It's tricky to confirm that. I mean, it's actually, we have no evidence to prove that. It's interesting that John doesn't say John the Apostle, and some people would say, therefore, he can't be the apostle because he was said he was. And other people say, well, the fact that he doesn't say so means it's so obvious that he was that he must be, if you get my drift. So, in other words, you could go either way on it. I'm not sure that it really matters. Some would say also that, you know, because John has a vision of the 12 apostles during this apocalyptic vision that he has, and he doesn't seem to sort of reference himself in any way. It's almost like a third party. It sort of suggests that maybe it wasn't one of the apostles writing this. Anyway, who really knows? What we do know, it was written towards the end of the first century. It was written from the island of Patmos, and it was written by somebody called John. The island of Patmos, which is just off the coast of present-day Turkey, what was called Asia Minor. In other words, this island where John is writing is just off the coast from where these churches are in the Aegean Sea between Greece and Turkey. All right, if you can picture that. Patmos at the time was a place of exile for political dissidents. The Romans would round up people who they felt had a dangerous subversive message and send them to remote islands to keep them quiet. They didn't actually, they didn't have that bad a life, it seems. There's certain legends about John really suffering on Patmos. I mean, that may have been true, but most of the historical evidence suggests that actually it was a pretty reasonable life that you had on Patmos. It was just you were out of circulation. They didn't want you propagating your message, and that's why they sent you there. So clearly there's something very subversive about John's message. And if you think about it, John's message is really saying that the powers that be right now, the powers in this evil age, are one day going to be defeated. We'll see as we look at some of the imagery that there's a clear association of a lot of the powers that be with the present-day power, then Rome. So you can imagine if somebody's propagating a message which is, don't worry because that power is going to be defeated one day and God's going to judge that power and God's going to defeat that power, that would be viewed as a pretty subversive message. Especially since, as we believe this was written in the era of the Emperor Domitian, who came after Nero, Domitian had unleashed all kinds of persecution on the Christian church because he was calling everybody in the empire to worship him as God. So if you read some of Suetonius, a Roman historian, read some of his writings, he kind of expresses disgust at the fact that Domitian is claiming to be God. So, you got the emperor saying, worship me not only as your political leader, but as a deity. The Christians would not have done that. And certainly, you imagine John would not have done that. And John, even before he's written this message to these seven churches, has already got himself into hot water and been put on this island. There's something very subversive about what he's saying. And what he's saying basically is the oppressed, the marginalized, the people who are under the thumb, the people who are on the losing side, one day it's all going to be turned around. And this hope. And that's not a message that the powers that be want to hear. So John's already in trouble. You wonder how he managed to get this message out. It must have been smuggled out in some kind of way, since he was pretty much under kind of island arrest, if you like, on Patmos. Some people have thought that this was written in the year of Nero, which would have put the date of the letter a little bit earlier, because Nero came before Domitian. But, looking at the evidence, it seems like Nero really, he was awful in his persecution of Christians, but it was pretty much isolated to Rome. And it wasn't based on religious grounds. It seems like Nero was just a psycho, really, and would trump up evidence for against certain groups of people in order to defend his own image and his own record, and he happened to pick on the Christians, but it was pretty much isolated to Rome. That kind of persecution wouldn't have gone out any further to Asia Minor, where John is writing to these churches, and clearly this message is going out to those churches when they're being persecuted. So it seems like it was during the era of Domitian. Okay, so it's a little bit of the historical background and context there. What also we see in those first passages is the rich imagery that John is using. His language is very interesting. Okay, so he uses very apocalyptic language. Again, I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a second, but he uses very apocalyptic language. He describes things that actually are not normal. You don't normally see seven golden lampstands and seven stars and things like that. He's describing a realm that not everybody seems to have access to or sight of. He's describing a spiritual realm, another dimension. And that might feel very weird to us. We may not be able to feel we can relate to that so well. But I think at another level, we're all aware that there's more to life than meets the eye, right? Even at a very basic level, right now this room is filled with all kinds of radiation. It's filled with molecules. It's filled with atoms. It's filled with gravity and other forces are exerting their influence through this room right now, and we can't see all those things. I mean, that would have sounded pretty crazy to the ancients if we had talked about in that kind of language to them. But also, I think we're aware that there's sort of dynamics and forces at play in our own life. I mean, there are influences on our lives that can feel very powerful at times. Family influences, societal influences, maybe government influences or whatever. We're aware of other powers and other unseen forces that play out in our lives. Would you agree with that? I mean, we all have that in some kind of a way. So maybe it's not quite as foreign as we think, but the way this is articulated in apocalyptic literature is that there's these images of good and evil. There's this battle being played out. And John, in this first few words, kind of gets a little bit, he dabbles in that imagery. The imagery is very vibrant, it's very dramatic. I mean, this first section isn't anywhere near as dramatic as some of the other ones, and it feels almost exaggerated. It's as though we're looking at something that is almost too bright to look at. And I think in that we get this sense of urgency, this sense of, this is important, this is real, it's almost too real. And if you think about the situation that the people were in at the time, the situation of suffering, I mean, to us right now, in a where we feel relatively comfortable, perhaps, it's like, well, that's a bit weird. But to the people at the time, when you describe good and evil in the radical way that John does, that would have meant an awful lot when you're suffering so badly, right? You don't want to get a message that, it's kind of not that bad. I mean, come on, you know, I mean, there's a few evil forces at play, and there's a little, God will win out in the end. I mean, you want something more dramatic than that, something stronger than that. And I think that's the beauty and the application of apocalyptic literature. It's bringing radical language and radical imagery to a very radically difficult situation. Now, I think it's important that we realize, again, go back to the first word of the book, that it's called an apocalypse, which means a revelation. It would be very easy for us to wonder if actually this is more of a mystery. It's more about confusing us. You know, some of this imagery and that kind of thing is more about confusing us than anything. Well, you know, I think to the original readers, a lot of the imagery would not have been confusing. A lot of the imagery would have made absolute sense to them. And sometimes, even in the writing, we'll see the imagery is given away. For instance, just after this passage, John explains what the seven golden lampstands mean and what the seven stars mean, and they represent the churches. I mean, so sometimes the imagery is kind of interpreted for us. At other times, it's quite obvious what it is. For instance, go back to the good old Whore of Babylon, she comes riding in on the beast. And the beast, we're told the Whore of Babylon represents a powerful city that has made all these deals with kings around the world. And this powerful city is built on seven hills, represented by the seven heads of the beast on which the Whore of Babylon is riding. And this city has caused death and destruction for all kinds of people. With a little bit of historical knowledge, what does that sound like? Rome, right? It sounds like Rome, built on seven hills, and it kind of pretty much fits the bill. I mean, people then would not have been thinking New York or London. They would have been thinking, and they wouldn't have been thinking Babylon, even though it's the Whore of Babylon. They would have been thinking, okay, Babylon represents an ancient empire, an ancient beast, if you like. What's the application for it today? And so very often the writer gives away clues that make it quite obvious what everything means. Now, I've got some illustrations here, because I think we do the same thing. For instance, if I was to put up an image like this, okay, what does that mean to us? What's our immediate, there's an immediate recognition of that. What does it mean? Republican, Democrat. Okay, so it's a political image. It represents something. When I first came to this country, I had no idea what those symbols meant whatsoever. I mean, and I know there's a background to where they came from, but it meant nothing to me. It was totally confusing to me. Let's look at some other examples of this. So what's that? What does that represent? Russia, okay, because Russia is traditionally represented as a bear in our culture. And I don't know when that came from. It's several hundred years ago, I think. And obviously that other image represents America, and we've got the world there. So we use these kind of images ourselves. There's another example. These are also political cartoons that immediately make sense to us. We can go even further back, actually, and this is from some British history. Britain's often represented as a lion, especially back then, because we were very powerful. This is back in the 19th century. Not so powerful now, these days. But as it happens to all great empires, they fail eventually. Here's some more, the lion and the bear. I mean, this is one from the Second World War. The one before that was from what's called the Great Game, when Britain and Russia were fighting over Central Asia, which eventually became part of the Soviet Union eventually in the early part of the 20th century. So, I think these images mean something, and we're, at another level, we're very comfortable with images. What we've got to be careful about, I think, with images is making sure that we recognize that these images represent something. So our job is to work out how what they represent applies to us, rather than working out how the image applies to us. Okay, so, you know, we can draw all kinds of conclusions about beasts and whores and this, that, and the other, and miss the point, because they are symbols. They're pointing towards something else. So as we, again, as we go through the book, we've got to, I think, take some good care of that. Here's another thing about how it's written. So it's using this rich apocalyptic imagery, which I think draws us in. That's the other thing that it does, I think, is it kind of pulls us in, and also acknowledges, even though, as we were saying, apocalypse means revelation, it means it's making something plain and obvious to us. In other words, John is saying, I'm going to reveal to you what's really going on right now. You think you're all on the losing wicket. You think you're all be defeated. You think this is the end. Let me tell you, no. Let me tell you what's really happening. Okay, so there's a kind of a revelation happening. But there is also mystery in this. And we're being drawn into that mystery. I think John is saying, hey, do you want to try and work out what this mystery means? He's drawing us in with these allusions and images and word pictures. And he's writing in a very unique style. Now, I don't read Greek myself, so I'm going on what other people are saying about this. But apparently it's written in parts in very poor Greek, or what some people felt was poor Greek. You know, one of the passages we just read, actually, is grammatically really bad. And some people thought, well, you know, probably the guy writing it, John, is a Hebrew. Greek's not his first language. You know, he you know, yeah, give him a break. But the trouble is, elsewhere in the book, he writes perfect Greek. So it seems like he's using at times intentionally incorrect grammar. And some thoughts on this are that John is using, if you like, the language of the street. He's using the vernacular. He's using abrasive language from the margins. And he's doing that for a couple of reasons. One, it's kind of in your face, so it's in the face of the powers that be. But also, as with lots of kind of vernacular language, you know how we use language within certain family settings or certain groups, certain ethnic groups use a certain kind of language. Certain nations take a whole language and change it, like English, you know, like what you guys did with it, and use different expressions and spell words differently and that kind of thing. It's a sign of identity. It's, you know, when we speak that way with one another, we're actually saying, you know, I'm like you. You're one of me. We're together in this. It also, to some degree, says we're not part of that, and it can be used as a way of being subversive. And there's thoughts that perhaps that's what John is doing here. He's deliberately using language that kind of is the language from the margins. So all the way it's written. The way it's written, the imagery it uses, really, I think, feeds into this appeal to people who are under great oppression, people who are really struggling, really suffering. And the issues throughout that are addressed, that are brought up, the issues of evil and hope are very relevant to these people. Now, let's just briefly hit the pause button there, because I want to go back to something I mentioned earlier that I said I'll come back to, and that's this issue of prophetic literature and apocalyptic literature. And, you know, I realize today some of this is a little bit technical, and we're going to apply it all in a second, okay? But I think it's important to get some of these things out of the way so that we can then get into the book and have some bearings, have a way of kind of working through it and interpreting it, knowing where we're treading. This book comes in the rich tradition of prophetic literature and apocalyptic literature. It's the only piece of complete apocalyptic literature in the New Testament, right? So there are other apocalypses. They didn't make it into the New Testament. There are also apocalypses that come from the Dead Sea Scrolls that predate Jesus. They're not about Jesus. They come from other communities of Jewish people who wrote about the suffering they were experiencing, because there was a lot of suffering going on in those centuries before Jesus came. And they wrote apocalyptic literature. But this is the only one that we have in the New Testament. We do have elements of apocalyptic literature in the Gospels. In fact, let's just take a quick look at those, if we could. Matthew 16 and Matthew 23. Is that possible? Can we just look at Matthew 16 one? Actually, not that part, because that was the. I think that is that. I think that's from Revelation. Oh, here we go. Yeah, so then Jesus said to his disciples, so this is Matthew chapter 16. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world, yet his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? That's a very familiar passage to us. I think we talk about that a lot here. Here's the immediate verses after it. For the Son of Man, was what was mentioned in Revelation, the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels. Then he will reward each person according to what he has done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death coming in his kingdom. In other words, Jesus is talking in apocalyptic terms there, and there's other examples of that. So there are pieces of apocalyptic terminology and apocalyptic writing within the Gospels and also within certain prophetic books like Ezekiel and also in the book of Daniel, which is really not, it's almost in its entirety an apocalyptic book. It's not really prophetic literature in the traditional sense of prophetic literature. So we have the other examples of it. So this is not, the point I'm trying to make, this is not an isolated piece of literature. It seems that way to us because we just don't get to see all this other literature. But this was one of many of this kind of writing. This one was deemed worthy to put in the Bible. Now, it's in the tradition of the prophets. The prophets were people who didn't predict the future so much. I mean, often we talk about prophecy like it's a prediction of the future. Their deal was this. God is present here and now. They're very similar. Their writing is very similar to the theme of Revelation in many respects, in that it has this sense of urgency. God is present. And you know what that means? That means that how we live really matters. We're accountable to a higher power. It doesn't matter whether the law says everything's okay. It doesn't matter whether we think everything's okay. When things are going, if we're doing wrong stuff, if we're oppressing people, if we're being selfish, if we're being immoral, it matters. And for them, this theme of evil and hope were the two main themes. Evil was really terrible. They wouldn't say, you could improve a little bit if you care. Please try and do better. You know, things could, you pull your socks up a little bit. No, everything's bad. Oppression is bad. Prophets wrote during the era when actually the people of Israel were more wealthy and powerful and in control than later on. And they're being challenged about what they're doing with that wealth, what they're doing with that power, what they're doing with that comfort. And everything may seem okay to them, but the prophets are saying, no, it's not okay, because look how you're living. So for them, things aren't just a little bit gray, they're black. But they also talk about an incredible future. They say, look, this is the way it could be. And they talk about the future in terms of how it could be positive for Israel. They broaden it out to how it could be positive for the nations. They broaden it out to how it could be positive for the whole planet. They even talk about how there'll be some kind of cosmic reconciliation back to God. So, where the lion will lie down with the lamb, where there'll be peace, and we'll be in a land flowing with milk and honey. You know, there's all these statements that talk about ultimate reconciliation to God. And they talk about that future hope and say, look, it's really, really bad, but it could be really, really, really good. Just imagine how it could be. And there's this sense of drama and passion that they spoke with. That is in some ways similar to the message we get in Revelation. Now, after the prophets came the people who were more persecuted. Okay, so the people of Israel went into exile. They got conquered by the Assyrians and the Babylonians. They started to suffer. They got dragged away into slavery. Then some of them begin to return, but then with the politics of the day, so we're talking about the few centuries here before Jesus. Alexander the Great, his empire gets broken up and it gets divided amongst all kinds of different groups, and some of those groups really persecuted the Hebrew people terribly. And during the era when they were being persecuted, we see prophetic writing evolving into a more apocalyptic literature, which basically says this. It says that it's very dualistic, what we call dualistic. There's good and there's evil. And that good and evil is being played out in this cosmic realm. We are subject to these unseen forces of good and evil. That's quite different to the prophets. The prophets said, look, make a choice. To them, good and evil is pretty human. Choose good or choose evil. It's up to you. You live better. Whereas the apocalyptic writers are saying, okay, there's something else out there. There's good forces and bad forces, and we are kind of in the middle of all these different forces. And we're being swayed one way or another. And on the side of good is God and the angels. And on the side of bad is Satan and the beasts and the demons and all those bad guys. And there's this kind of cosmic battle being played out. And right now, it seems like evil is winning. You're suffering. You're persecuted. Life is bad. Evil is winning. But there's a day coming when God will return. Well, in fact, the language that's used by the apocalyptic writers is the Son of Man, this figure, the Son of Man, who later became sort of associated with being the Messiah. The Son of Man will return and defeat evil. Evil will be brought to an end. The dead will be raised. Everybody will be judged. Good people will judge. Bad people will judge. The wicked will get their recompense. So they, in other words, the wicked will not get away with all that they've been getting away with any longer. And then there will be a new age, a new era in which we live in harmony with God, in which this beautiful age. So it's dualistic in the sense of God, good and evil, God and Satan. It's dualistic in the sense of there's this present age and there's the age to come. And if you've read the Gospels at all, you'll know that Jesus talked about this present age. And he talked about the age to come. And some people would profess that Jesus was had a strong apocalyptic influence. It's debatable. I mean, clearly he was influenced by this tradition. He was associated with John the Baptist, who talked very much with that kind of language. But, you know, there's a debate about how much Jesus was influenced that way. But either way, what you can say, I think, is that Jesus taught in those kind of terms. But there's a big difference. Jesus seemed to reinterpret and bring a fresh interpretation to this sense of the present age and the age to come. In apocalyptic literature, there's a clear division. This age comes to an end with the resurrection of the dead, the judgment, and then the new age comes in. What Jesus said was, my kingdom is at hand. My kingdom is present. In other words, this age that's to come has come from the future into the present. It's here now in me. I'm bringing that future age of hope, right into the present. It's as though this future age and this present age begin to overlap, and we are living in the middle of it, according to Jesus. We are living in a time when the evil is still around. There is still death. Death hasn't been defeated. There isn't resurrection of the dead. But Jesus says, so there is still that time to come, but I'm bringing that time into the present. There's still this ultimate fulfillment to come, but I'm going to bring this hope, this new dynamic, this new way of the universe operating into the present. And that new age begins now. And you can experience it through me. And the incredible thing is that Jesus then goes to the cross. And he's crucified as the King of the Jews, right? He's crucified as the King of this kingdom. So the power of this kingdom is not what you would expect. The power of this new age is not about forces that defeat and judge. The power of this new way is one of love and self-sacrifice and forgiveness. It's a complete surprise. It's not what you would expect whatsoever. When we look at the king, we're looking at somebody who gave up his life, who surrendered, who did not fight back, who showed incredible love and provided a way for us all to experience the dynamic presence of that future age in the here and now. Now, we're going to kind of trace some of that as we go through Revelation. We're going to wrap it up now, though, and just say just this. What if that was true? Like, we can read Revelation and the forces of good and the forces of evil, and read about beasts and angels and this kind of thing. And, you know, those things seem very symbolic. They're part of a way of describing things. You know, some people would take those things literally. Some people would see them as figurative. Whatever the case, something is being described for us. A different kind of reality is being described for us. What if it was true? What if the universe really did change through Jesus? What if life really is different? What if we need to experience some of that kind of revealing? What if there are things that hide that reality from us? What if that were to come into focus, that with vibrancy and dynamism for us? that new life. What, could it be true? I mean, could that be our experience? Could that be our reality? In other words, in all of the darkness that we experience, in all of the suffering that we experience in different ways, and we may not be able to relate to the kind of suffering that those people that are being written to in Western Turkey were experiencing, but in all the struggle with evil that we experience, and let's face it, we are subject to evil and we are perpetrators of evil. Could it be that we could participate in new creation, what Paul called new creation? And Paul said, if anyone is in Christ, in other words, if anybody is in this new way, he doesn't even say actually they will be a new creation. He just says new creation. In other words, new possibilities. Could it be in all of our darkness, in all of our evil, in all of our struggle, that new possibilities are possible? New creation is possible. Perhaps that's what we can take into this series as we think about applying it. In what ways can the present dynamic life of Christ capture us with the same kind of intensity and urgency that it with which it captured the prophets, with which it captured the writers of apocalyptic literature, with which it captured Jesus, with which it captured John the Baptist, with which it captured his first followers, with which it captured John, who's writing this book? We're going to move now into a time of communion, and we celebrate